hoping that everyone can hear us. Ian is going to get started on his presentation, How to the Next Generation.
Okay, hopefully everybody can hear me. I won't bother to say speak up if you can't hear me, because that's rather pointless. So currently we're looking at slide one, which is just the title slide, How to the Next Generation. So let's move on to slide number two. So slide number two just gives some background and motivation about OWL. I can see the slides in the virtual screen thingy are changing, so Peter presumably can hear me and is changing them. So slide two gives some background and motivation for the existence of OWL. And as I suppose we probably all know, OWL, the development of OWL was motivated by the web activity, where the goal was to add meaning to web content by annotating it with terms defined in ontologies. It was quite reasonably determined that if this was going to work well, we would need to have a standard web ontology language in the same way that we have a standard markup language for web pages, which is HTML, obviously. So the W3C set up the WebOnt working group, whose mandate was to develop such a language. And the idea was basically to extend existing languages such as RDF, and also to exploit earlier work on developing ontology languages for the web, in particular the OIL language and the XAML plus OIL language. OIL was a language that was developed in an EU project, and the XAML program, many of you will remember, was a large program funded in the by DARPA in the US. That was basically the goal of that was to push forward the development of this semantic web vision. And the DAML and the OIL people got together, produced this language called DAML plus OIL, which was a precursor for OWL, with a bit of RDF mixed in as well. So eventually this ontology language became a recommendation on the 10th of Feb 2004, and it rapidly became very widely used. It's now supported by a large range of tools and infrastructure. These include a whole range of APIs, the most widely used one of which I believe is the OWL API, but there are others. There are also a number of well-known ontology development environments, including Protégé and Top-Grade Composer, and there are also a number of reasoning and information systems, some of which are used directly with tools like Protégé, and others of which can be built into web applications, semantic web applications, we should say. And these reasoners include tools like Pellet, Hermit, Quanto, and so on. The OWL language was sort of a formal underpinning to that, the formal semantics to that were provided by a description logic, this logic with a funny name, which, as I think I explained last week, is really just an acronym for the features provided in the logic. And also you can understand that this description logic is really just a decidable subset of first-order logic that was designed, to be suitable for ontology design, and B, to be implementable in tools like Pellet, Hermit, Quanto, and so on. Okay, so that's the background to OWL. So let's move on to slide three. So I already mentioned that there's now lots of tools and infrastructure for OWL, and OWL is being more and more widely deployed in a range of different applications, including areas like e-science, e-commerce, geography, engineering, defense, like I could go on. The typical use for owl tools is to identify and repair, well, it's to improve the design of ontologies, and this involves identifying and repairing errors. And there was a nice example presented by, if I remember rightly, it was people from, was it people from the Mayo Clinic? Anyway, at an owl-led workshop, there was a paper presented that described using owl to help to develop a medical ontology that they were using in the PATH lab, and they used the tools to identify errors that would have actually led to missed test results if the errors hadn't been corrected, and obviously that would have had an adverse effect on patient care. And another interesting recent example that I only found out about a week or so ago is the fact that OWL and RDF have actually been used in the website that the BBC used to provide information about the World Cup. That's the soccer World Cup for the Americans amongst us, football World Cup for everyone else. And actually, that's quite a fancy website there that with lots of metadata using RDF and an OWL would be in order to automatically provide various links between pages and so on. So the use of OWL in these various applications led people to recognize that actually, nice though it was, there were various restrictions that made it sometimes difficult to use. And two particular kinds of restriction that were identified were restrictions on the expressive power, so sometimes people wanted to represent things in their ontology that turned out to be difficult or impossible to represent with OWL. And the other problem that people identified was scalability. So sometimes people were trying to use OWL to build or deploy extremely large applications, large ontologies, sorry, or very large data sets. And sometimes when doing that, they ran into scalability problems. In the meantime, if you remember from the previous slide, I mentioned that the OWL standard went back to 2004, and actually, of course, the standardization process was based on various research that was conducted quite a bit before that. So as it's kind of inevitable with these, with these sort of standardization processes, you end up with people using a language that's based on research that, you know, 6 or 7 or even more years out of date. And in the meantime, a great deal of additional research had been done, and that had already shown how many of these kinds of problems that were emerging in experience with OWL could have been overcome. So luckily the W3C recognized that there was a good opportunity there and established another working group to do a relatively quick refresher on OWL and produce a revision of the language that incorporated some of these new possibilities. The idea was to come up with a radical change to OWL, but really just a sort of incremental extension, and the hope was that that could be done reasonably quickly, which indeed it was, and the resulting language is now also a W3 recommendation, which actually precedes the original OWL recommendation and is called OWL 2. So, we move on to our slide number 4. I'll give a very quick run through what are the new features that have been added to OWL that distinguish it from OWL 2 that distinguish it from OWL 1. So as I already mentioned, the idea was to extend OWL, but only in a small way. So kind of mandate for the working group actually specified that it should add a small set of features that were needed in applications, so we weren't supposed to add anything gratuitously just because we knew how to do it. that shouldn't be enough of a reason to add it. There should really be some requirement coming for applications. Obviously, it should be the case that we only added things that we really knew how to do, so we should only add things where the sort of underpinning research had already provided a clear definition of the semantics and reasoning techniques. And finally, we didn't want to, I mean, one of the beauties of OWL has been that it was supported by a wide range of tools, and we didn't want to damage that situation. So we restricted ourselves to providing features that we already had good buy-in from tool builders for. So tool builders told us ahead of time, yeah, you know, if you extend the language with that feature, we'll probably extend our tool to support it. It won't be too much of a problem. So they were the sort of criteria for selecting the kinds of feature we were going to add. One of the other important things that we wanted to now to was this idea of profiles, which I discussed at some length last week. So this was particularly aimed at the issue of scalability, and it was known, widely recognized, known that the full OWL language is highly complex to reason with, both from a theoretical and a practical perspective, but in the meantime, since the definition of OWL, more work had been done on identifying smaller languages, subsets of OWL, that had much better computational properties. And it was also recognized that that was, having better computational properties was an important feature for identifying subset languages that would be useful to actually give a name to and declare that would be a useful fragment that people might want to employ in applications. But one of the problems with OWL1 was that the only fragment identified was OWL-like, and there wasn't any good practical or theoretical justification for identifying that particular fragment. It was really rather ad hoc, and it turned out not to be much use, and hardly any tools actually supported OWL-like, or if they did, they also supported the full language, so there was no real advantage in either supporting or using OWL-like. As Peter said at the beginning, I can see a few people are asking questions in the chat, and I don't wish to be rude, but it turns out that it's actually quite complicated trying to answer these questions as we go along, and it doesn't work very well either for recording the presentation and listening to it offline. So I'll just plow through, and if people can sort of keep hold of their questions to the end, I will try to come back to all of them in due course. So another kind of design constraint for OWL2 was that it should be fully backwards compatible with OWL. So we didn't want to introduce any features that would have resulted in some original OWL ontologies no longer being valid ontologies with respect to OWL2. So one of the important features of OWL2 is that every OWL ontology is a valid OWL2 ontology. We also even wanted to make the backwards compatibility constraint a little bit stronger than that. So basically, we only wanted OWL2 to be different from OWL1 to the extent that was necessary in order to support the new features. So in other words, every OWL2 ontology that doesn't use any of those new features should also be a valid OWL ontology. And that's how the design works. One of the nice things about OWL2 was the fact that as we were going along, I mean, the tool developers actually really kept pace with the development of the language, so that there were tools supporting OWL2 even before the standard was actually fully ratified. So tools like Protege, Hermes, Pellet, Copilot, Factor+, and the Owl API, were all developing support for L2 even before we finished with the standard, which was even a much better situation than we were in with the original Owl language. So to go in a bit more detail into what the new features are, there were basically four different kinds of new feature. And the first kind of feature was designed to deal with this problem that people have found some things difficult to express, or rather impossible to express, and they required more expressive power in the language. And there were several features of this kind. The first one was the feature that in the description logic space people call qualified cardinality restrictions. And these are statements of the form, being able to define persons who have two friends who are Republicans. So in the original OWL, you could only define cardinality with respect to properties. You can only do this counting. You could only say something like persons who have two friends. You weren't able to express things like two friends who had certain properties. I mean, they may have any number of friends who don't have those properties, but they better only have two friends with those particular properties. No way to express that in the original OWL. Actually, this was one of those features that we could have added in the original OWL because, actually, it was already supported in the underlying logic. But for some reason, at the time we decided OWL, we decided in our wisdom that this was one feature too many in the language, and somehow it wasn't justified by application. But it turned out that was a bad call, and many applications really wanted to have this feature. And in particular, for example, the biomedical people use this feature all of the time in order to define things like, a hand has exactly four fingers and one thumb, four parts of the fingers and one part of the thumb. And you couldn't describe that using the original OWL. So another feature that was added to OWL 2 was this property chain feature. So one of the most famous examples of things you couldn't describe using OWL was this sort of uncle example. So, basically the problem with OWL is it has quite a rich language for describing classes, but it only has a relatively weak language for describing properties and their relationship to other properties. So basically in OWL 1, the only things you could really do were say that one property was a subclass of another property, and you could say a couple of things like that properties were transitive and that properties were symmetrical, if I remember rightly. But this didn't allow you to specify relationships between one property and a chain of other properties, which is what you need to do if you want to define what uncle is in terms of properties like brother and parent. So it turns out in many applications it's very convenient to be able to define these sorts of shortcut properties. So if I follow one property edge that's parent and another property edge that's brother, then that individual that I get to, I should be able to also get there in a single property edge which is labeled uncle from the place that I started. And L2 provides this feature by allowing sub-property assertions to include chains of properties. In fact, you don't just have to, you're not limited to having two properties. You can even say, property followed by property 2, followed by property 3, followed by property 4, implies property 5, and you can define these shortcut properties that way. There are some restrictions, rather complicated restrictions, unfortunately, in just how you can combine that property properties in that way. Basically, these restrictions exclude defining cycles where the shortcut property on the right-hand side of the sub-property axiom is somehow reused on the left-hand side to get these kind of cyclical definitions. That's ruled out in AL2 because it's known to lead to undecidability. So another feature that was added in AL2 was local reflexivity. So in certain applications, it's nice to be able to assert that there's a property link back to yourself. So the classic example of this is narcissists who love themselves. And so to define the class of narcissists, you have to be able to make these assertions that there's a loop property labeled with love from the individual back to themselves. AL2 also added a bunch of other descriptions of properties. So instead of just being able to say they were symmetric, you could also assert things like global reflexivity, irreflexivity, and asymmetry of properties. And this allows you, for example, to assert that nothing can be a proper part of itself, which basically means that you're stating that the proper part of property would be irreflexive. AL2 also introduced the possibility to assert disjointness between properties. So, for example, you could say that the parent and the child property, parent of and child of, are disjoint, because obviously no two individuals can be both in a parent of relationship and a child of relationship, so you can't be both the child and the parent of the same person. Finally, AL2 introduced this extremely useful feature that's well known in databases but hadn't previously been supported in ontology languages, called keys. So you'd like to be able to say something like, the country plus the license plate constitute a unique identifier for vehicles. And AL2 allows you to make that kind of statement. There are some limits on that, though. Basically, these keys only apply to named individuals. So the keys only, if you have two individuals, two actual named vehicles that have the same country and the same license plate, then an owl reasoner will deduce that they must be the same vehicle. But if you use existential restrictions to imply the existence of anonymous individuals, but you can somehow deduce that two of these anonymous individuals have the same key values, the reasoner won't deduce that those anonymous individuals must be identified. And again, the reason for that is decidability. If you allow that, the language would immediately become undecidable. So if we move on to slide 6. The second kind of new feature that was introduced in AL2 was extended data type. So it was almost immediately recognized after AL1 was developed that one of the weaknesses was the fact that there was very little support in the language for different data types. Basically, you could just say that values of a property were strings or integers, but you couldn't say anything about them, like integers in the range 1 to 5, or anything like that. It's extremely weak, and it soon became apparent that being able to constrain the kinds of data types that the kinds of value you had and use a much wider range of data types would be important in applications. So if we move on to slide 7. So one of the first things that was added to AL2 was a much wider range of XSV data types. So instead of just integer and string, basically AL2 supports all of the sort of reasonable XSV data types. So there are some rather messy XSV data types, mainly to do with dates and times. But all the kind of standard ones are supported in ALTO. So if we move on to slide 8. And in addition to just supporting the standard data type, AL2 also allows for the use of FATA. So this covers the kind of value constraints that I was mentioning a moment ago. So you could use this to say something like the maximum weight of an airmail letter has to be, can be no larger than 20. So you can actually use FATA to basically what that amounts to doing is defining your own data type, which is the data type which are integers less than and including 20. And this is the XSD definition for that in the example on the slide. Then on slide 9, another example is that you could use another kind of facet is a pattern restriction. So you can use pattern restrictions to define a subset of a string. Again, this is really just like defining your own data type, which is just those strings which match this pattern. And you could use that, for example, to define the structure of Italian registration plates, which have two letters followed by three numbers followed by two more letters. Then on slide 10. So that was basically it for data types. Actually, I think there was one additional thing I didn't mention on the slide there was that you can also introduce a name for these newly defined data types. So you can actually introduce a name in the ontology, which might be something like Italian number plate, and define that to be equal to this data type, which is defined using XSD string and a pattern facet. And then instead of having to write this complicated XSD definition everywhere in your ontology where you want to talk about Italian number plates, you can just use the data type name that you defined. So slide 10 we're on now. The third kind of new feature in AL2 was extended support for meta modeling and annotation. So one of the things that was rather weak again in AL was its support for annotations. The main problem was that AL1 was restricted by RDF, and RDF's lack of any kind of named graph feature or any way of referring to anything other than a single URI. So you can't refer to a whole graph and have a property, an RDF property, that attaches to that whole graph. You can only attach properties to nodes in the graph. So basically, that meant that you could only annotate single entities, such as classes or individuals. And this turned out to be a really serious limitation in AL, because in ontologies, I mean, people often want to annotate statements. They want to annotate a statement saying something like, this statement was added to the ontology on the, 5th of May 2009, or it was added by such a person, and there's no way to refer to this statement in RDF, so AL didn't support that. So AL2 extended the meta-modeling features in many different ways. So the first way in which it was extended was actually to allow for a restricted form of meta-modeling. So one of the other restrictions that people recognized in AL1 was that they often wanted to use the same name as a class in one place and then as an individual in another place. And there's obviously nothing to stop you doing that in RDF. And actually, people doing that in ontologies was one of the main causes of ontologies being owl full ontologies and not owl DL ontologies, because people would do this kind of meta-modeling thing. The reason it wasn't allowed in OWL 1 was that at least if you interpret that in a naive way, it basically takes you outside of first order logic, because you end up using a predicate in the position of a variable or constant. So we didn't want to go outside of first order logic, so this wasn't allowed. In OWL 2, we decided to kind of finesse the issue by allowing this, but basically, when the same name is used as a class or as an individual, there's no logical connection between the two things, and this is why this is called punning. So you're using the same name, but the name is somehow also associated with the context. So you can imagine whenever you use, in this example, Snow Leopard as a class, somehow you can think of the name as being the class Snow Leopard. And whenever you use Snow Leopard as an individual, you can really think of the name as being the individual Snow Leopard. And there's no relationship between the two things. But at least you're allowed to do this kind of meta-modeling, and it doesn't push you out of being in the kind of DL version of OWL. Typically as well, you find in applications that people use this sort of meta-modeling more as a kind of annotation mechanism, and they don't really expect inferences to flow from a class to an individual, and then for that individual to be treated as a class in a different way because of some inference that flowed from the meta class. So typically punning doesn't really cause the loss of inferences that people expect. I already mentioned about the annotation of axioms, so I spoke about that first. Sorry about that, I made these first 2 points in the reverse order. And the annotation mechanism that OWL2 provides is quite powerful. Once we decided that we could add annotations to arbitrary things, then we went overboard and decided, well, we might even want to have annotations of annotations. And apparently that is actually used in ontologies. So it's a significant feature. So let's move on to slide number 11. So this, I think, if I've remembered my features right, this is the final one of the four features that OWL2, four kind of expressive features that OWL2 added. And these are features that look as though they're adding expressive power, but they don't really add anything. They're just what we call syntactic sugar. So they don't allow you to express anything you couldn't express before. They just make it a little bit easier to do so. And one example is disjoint union. So actually, this is quite a common modeling paradigm, so it's quite common to say something like, element is the disjoint union of earth, wind, fire, and water. But you could express that in OWL, but it was rather cumbersome because you had to express the union and then the disjointness separately. And another thing that, again, you can express in OWL, but it's rather cumbersome, are negated assertions. So you'd like to be able to say that some particular fact doesn't hold. So you might like to say something like, Mary is not the sister of Ian, or sadly, 21 is not the age of Ian. And you could do this in OWL, but again, it was kind of cumbersome, and you had to know how to transform, do various logical transformations in order to be able to express that. Okay, so if we move on to slide 12. So they were all of the kind of syntactic features, the expressive features that were added to OWL 2. So now we have this new language that was a superset of OWL. It had some additional expressive features, additional annotations, and some additional syntactic sugar. And then basically the rest of the work of the working group was adding sort of infrastructure and convenience features. And one of the things we wanted to do was support some more syntaxes. So we still have the normative RDF XML exchange syntax that basically looks exactly like the original OWL. Well, it is exactly the original OWL syntax with just the extra bits added in order to support the new features. And if you remember, one of the constraints on OWL 2 was that if I don't use any of the new features, the ontology I get should be a valid OWL ontology. In other words, the RDF XML that I get by serializing that ontology will be exactly the same as I would have got by serializing the initial OWL ontology. But we wanted to also support some additional syntaxes in OWL 2. One of those, again, is very similar to, there was a similar feature in OWL 1, which is the functional syntax. And this is mainly intended for use in the specification. I don't think very many people use functional syntax for writing down their ontologies, although I have seen some people using it for, discussing ontologies in email and so on, because it's much more succinct and convenient than trying to write down the RDF XML. More importantly, one of the things we wanted to do in OWL 2 was support a fully fledged XML syntax. There was an XML syntax for OWL 1, but it actually hadn't really been very thoroughly developed. I think it was only not really part of the full spec, and actually it wasn't fully specified, and there were some problems with it. And we wanted to define an XML syntax for OWL 2 that could capture the whole language and that basically had a sort of one-to-one correspondence with the functional syntax. And the reason for that was to promote interoperability with the XML toolchain. Finally, one of the things that obviously people found problematical with the original OWL was that there was no syntax that was very easy to sort of write down for non-expert users. The nearest you could get to that was the functional syntax. So in OWL 2, we decided to standardize what had become a sort of de facto standard used in a lot of ontology tools and editors, which was invented by people in Manchester and had become known as the Manchester syntax. And this allows you to the examples that I've written down on the previous few slides actually all give this definition of heart being a muscular organ that's part of the circulatory system. On slide 14, I gave it in XML syntax. In slide 13, I gave it in the functional syntax. And in slide 12, I gave it in the RDF XML syntax. And I hope that most of us can agree that the version on slide 15, which is the Manchester syntax, is much easier to write down, more intuitive for human beings, and promotes readability. And actually, several editors, allow you to just type in this stuff directly, and it's pretty easy to do. So that was it for syntaxes. If we move on to slide 16, the other thing I mentioned that was a big motivation for OWL 2 was to identify some more subsets which were useful, which were going to be really useful, had features that made them worth defining, and in particular that provided better computational properties. And the motivation for this is the very high worst-case complexity of the full language, which is doubly non-deterministically exponential, which isn't good. As I said last week, and I think it's always worth re-emphasizing this, it doesn't mean that it's always, things are always going to blow up with that kind of exponential increase in difficulty of reasoning. But it means that that can happen. And it means that using the full language, you have to be, you have to expect a certain lack of robustness with respect to computational behavior. So it's possible that you can just change small things in your ontology, and that can lead to a big change in the computational behavior of the tools that you're using. So moving to a lower complexity class, what that does is it increases this robustness. I mean, it generally lets you deal with larger ontologies and data sets, but in a way, the most important thing is robustness. If your ontology is, if your application's working well today, you can be reasonably sure that it'll work well tomorrow if you only make relatively modest changes to the ontology or the data set. As I already mentioned, OWL only defined one profile, which was OWL Lite, and unfortunately that wasn't based on any sort of complexity theoretic motivation. It actually turned out also to have exponential, worst case exponential behavior, and so it didn't really offer any particular advantage, and it wasn't really ever widely used. So if I move on to slide 17, we can see that the three different profiles were defined in OWL. One was this profile called OWL2EL, and the motivation for that profile was to try to identify the largest subset of the language that for which we could provide polynomial time reasoning, particularly with respect to large ontologies, but it also turns out to be the case that this language is polynomial in respect of the data. So as you increase the size of the data set, the reasoning can get polynomially harder, but that's the worst case. The second profile that was defined was a profile called OWL2QL, which stands for query language. Unfortunately, EL doesn't really stand for anything very much. It's a sort of obscure reference to a description logic on which that language is based, the EL description logic. But QL, that name is a kind of an acronym for OWL query language, and the reason it's called that is that this was a maximal fragment such that it's possible to rewrite queries against an OWL ontology into queries against a data store, for example, an SQL database, or equally a Sparkle endpoint. And this, the motivation for this is that it's a very nice feature to have if you want to deal with and even more so if those data sets are already stored in relational databases, RDS stores, whatever large-scale storage mechanism you're using. And you'd like to just leave them there, use an ontology with them, and use a reasoning method that just took the query against the ontology and rewrote it into a query against the data store. And then finally, RL was the third profile that was defined, and this stands for OWL Rule Language. And the reason it's called that is that this profile was designed to be one that could be implemented using forward chaining rule engines to materialize inferences in the data store. So this is also focused on applications where you're using large sets of data, but in this case, it's envisaged that rather than rewriting the query and leaving the data alone, what you would do is you would simply materialize, you basically saturate the store using the ontology as and some forward-looking rules to kind of materialize all of the instances, and then you can just answer queries by querying directly against the data store. And OWL2RL was designed to be a language for which such implementations were possible and could provide computational guarantees. obviously there are lots of existing systems that work that way, but in most cases they're incomplete. And the reason for defining RL the way it's defined is that it's possible to provide at least a limited form of complete reasoning with forward chaining rule engines. So I said that the presentation was going to be very short, and I've spent much longer talking about these things than I intended to do. So I'm going to skip over the remaining slides a bit more quickly so as to make sure we've got plenty of time for discussion at the end. So if we go on to slide 18, here I basically just reiterate in a bit more detail some of the things I already just said about RL2L. It's a neo-maximal fragment such that you can do polynomial time reasoning. It's based on this existential fragment of description logic, which is called the EL family. And it allows you, I didn't mention in the EL, but EL also allows you to exploit a different kind of reasoning technique, which is a saturation-based technique where rather than saturating the data set, you saturate the axiom set. So basically, you can extend the ontology in order to include all interesting axioms. And then queries against the ontology basically just become a sort of lookup. Is the thing I'm looking for explicitly stated there in the ontology? If it is, then the answer is yes, and if it isn't, then the answer is no. So if we flip onto slide 19, basically this just gives you a little hint as to how these saturation-based techniques work, and that will be sort of familiar to anyone who's seen resolution-style reasoning, but I don't really have time to go into it now. But it's there for interest. And if you want more detail on that, you can look at my presentation from last week, which had a worked example showing how that would actually produce inferences. If we flip onto slide 20, again, I don't think this is so important this week. I was just showing that this is just some data that shows how you can really get a huge speed up on reasoning using this saturation-based technique. So just to take one example, this Galen version 7 ontology, which is in the fourth ontology along, it's a reasonably large ontology that uses quite an expressive set of axioms, and no existing reasoner was able to classify that at all. And a new reasoner built using the saturation technique, the CB reasoner, the times for which are given in red on the next to bottom line, that could classify this guy in 9.5 seconds, even though other reasoners had been left running literally for months and not succeeded in all that time in completing this classification. So if we flip onto slide 21, again, I already basically mentioned most of the information that's in this slide. RL2QL is a maximum fragment such that you can do you can answer queries against RL ontologies using query rewriting, the advantages of that are fairly obvious. You take your ontology, you take your query, and you just produce a new query that you can then use against the data directly. So if you flip to slide 22, I say a bit more about how that works a little more formally. So if you've got an ontology, which we're calling O in this case, and a query Q, then I use the ontology to rewrite Q into a new query Q prime, which is bigger than Q and which sort of incorporates the knowledge from the ontology, such that if I ask the original query against the data set, the ground fact, which I'm calling A here, then the answer I get to that query will be exactly the same as the answer I get to my expanded query with respect to an empty ontology. So basically, once I've rewritten the query, I can ignore the ontology from there on in and just answer the query against the data. and I can do that using, for example, SQL. Again, in this slide and the next several slides, I've got some details about how this query rewriting technique works, but it's a little technical, and I won't have time to go into it now. People can work through that offline if they're interested. So let's flip forward to slide 27. So basically, this just reiterates again what I was saying and gives a concrete example of how you could take this query and the ontology that I gave several slides back, and it shows how you can rewrite it into an SQL query. So if I flip on to slide 28, again, this really just reiterates what I was saying when I introduced the RL fragment back on the slide that talked about all three fragments. It's the maximal one such that you can use these standard rule engines to implement it. The trick is basically to allow for situations where you only need to worry about the named individuals, so you're not allowed to have existentials on the right-hand side of axioms that introduce new anonymous individuals. So basically it suffices to consider Herbrand models for those of us who know what Herbrand models are. And the language is designed in such a way that you can provide these correctness guarantees under certain circumstances. So flip forward to slide 29. And the last but not least thing that we wanted to do in OWL 2 was improve the quality of the spec. So flip forward to slide number 30. And this included, for example, using UML as well as the functional syntax in order to define the syntax, so there were proper UML specifications of the syntax. If we flip forward to slide number 31, another really important thing was having a deterministic and bidirectional mapping to the RDF XML syntax. The specification for OWL was extremely strange in this regard. It basically gave a definition for how to take an ontology in the functional syntax and map it into XML RDF. But the only way you could look at some RDF graph and decide whether that was a valid OWL ontology was, because there was no reverse mapping defined, it was a valid OWL ontology just in case you could find an OWL ontology such that the forward mapping would give you the RDF graph that you were looking at. Obviously, that's a really horrible condition to have to check. So I give you an XML RDF graph, and I say, tell me, is that the valid OWL ontology? And basically, naively, you have to iterate through all possible OWL ontologies and see if running the forward mapping gives the graph that you're looking at. Clearly, that's, you know, completely crazy. And in fact, no OWL tools did that. They used a sort of ad hoc reverse mapping. So in OWL 2, we tightened up the definition and actually provided an explicit reverse mapping such that an RDF graph is an OWL 2 ontology just in case you can run it through this reverse mapping. I already mentioned we provided fully formed RDF XML and human readable syntaxes, and we also provided a better selection of user-facing documents, including a quick reference card. So we flip forward to 32, number 32. That actually, it's a two-sided card. This shows you, probably quite hard to read in the slide, but you can imagine that's one side of this quick reference card, which shows you basically all of the language. And onto slide number 33. This just gives you an overview of the OWL 2 specification. I mean, it looks kind of complicated, but we just split things down into different documents where several of these things were combined into single documents in the OWL 1 spec. It seemed cleaner to do it this way, and we provided this nice roadmap that allowed you to look at what you're interested in and jump to the relevant document. So sorry I ran through a bit quickly there, but if we jump to slide number 34, as I said before, I want to take a little time for discussion, so I'll shut up now and take questions. Thank you. Well, I see several people putting their hand up on the queue, but actually nobody seems to be chairing.
Todd Snyder here.
Hello, Todd.
You answered one of my questions, which is the use of UML and specifications. Another question comes up is, so I had asked earlier, you referred to certain research that was done that prompted some of the decisions. I was wondering if you could provide some references at some point, some of those articles?
Obviously it's much easier for me to sort of do that.
Well, later.
Yeah, but actually, if you look at the slide deck from last week, if I remember rightly, I had a slide at the end of that slide deck that provided a mini bibliography.
Oh.
If it isn't at the end of that slide deck, then you'll have to email me and ask me. But I mean, basically, this was research that had gone on in the description logic and ontology communities. For example, the description, I mentioned the description logic that underpinned OWL1 was a language called Soin. And in the intervening years, people had extended that language with the sorts of operators that I was describing, like role chain inclusions and so on. And that resulted in a description logic called Throik. And there was a paper. Throik was originally described, I believe, in a paper that was at about KR 2006 or something like that.
So it's not included in the handbook?
In the description logic handbook. Actually, there's a new version of the description logic handbook that I think it at least mentions it in the chat, because that's for the chapter on OWL. And I think that new version might at least mention it there.
Okay, my last question, actually, I have two other questions quickly. When you talked about saturation here with regard to the like the T-box, you meant by just doing a closure?
Of course, you can't saturate the T-box completely because there are potentially infinite number of axioms that you could derive.
Mm-hmm.
But what you can do, if you're mainly interested in classification, you can saturate the T-box with respect to atomic inclusion axioms. So you can imagine, you can do that, and there's only a finite number of such axioms, because at most you can, of course, have the cross product of all the atomic names that are there. I mean, in order to do the saturation, you may derive some other axioms that are not of that form, but you can also show that that's only a finite number of axioms.
So it's just a closure under a subset of the operators?
It's closure. You can close the T-box under atomic subsumption. I mean, the technique for doing it produces some non-atomic axioms, but still only a finite number of axioms. And then, if you want to know if A subsumes B, where A and B are class names, then you just have to look in the ontology and see if you have an axiom A subclass B. And if you don't, then they're not in the subsumption relationship.
And one sort of outlier question here, is there any way to use the annotation capabilities to mimic skolemization?
Annotation capabilities to mimic skolemization. I'm not quite sure why you would use annotation to do that. I mean,
is there a better
why
one?
Wouldn't you just give a name to... Why wouldn't you just change a sort of existentially quantified individual into a named individual?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure what you mean by mimic skolemization.
Maybe I was just trying to be too clever. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks for the question. So, in default of any chair, I guess I'll chair myself and say that I don't know how to pronounce the second name, Ryan, seems to be next on the queue.
Hi, and yeah, it's Jim Ryan.
Ryan, hi, Jim.
Yeah, so I actually put the question in the chat as well. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about what you think is next for OWL. And in particular, I know there was recently a meeting around next steps for RDF, and I'd like to see what your perspective is on how that might influence OWL.
Right, okay, that's a good question. I mean, it's obviously very tough to say because there are lots of different constituencies, all of whom have different, you know, must-have requirements for both RDF and OWL, so it's always very, very difficult to decide where the languages are going to go next. I mean, as I understand it, most of the proposed extensions to RDF wouldn't really impact very much on OWL, other than it would make it easier to do things that we're already doing. I mean, for example, named graphs is one of the extensions to OWL that people have been asking for a long time, and would have been very useful for us when we were extending the annotation capabilities, but in default of them, we had to use some rather complicated homegrown reification procedure in order to attach annotations to statements rather than just a node. As far as OWL is concerned, there are a group of people who have been working for a long time on a fuzz version of OWL, and they have been sort of trying to push the idea that, you know, a next step might be a fuzzy OWL. I'm not totally convinced about that myself, because I'm not really convinced that implementations are currently really scalable. Another thing that people have been very enthusiastic about is some recent work on extending OWL with rules, basically. I mean, there have been various different versions of rule extensions to description logic, of which you're probably familiar with. There were things like Swirl, for example, that was quite widely used, even though it was only a member submission. But the trouble with Swirl is that it really just adds rules to OWL in an unrestricted way, and that makes the language undecidable. And if we were going to extend OWL, I think we'd probably like to try to stay still decidable. And there was some recent work on how to extend OWL with rules in a way that maintained decidability. And that looks like quite a likely feature, I think, that we might want to have, and that would also fit in very nicely with the recent RIF work.
Okay, if I could follow up, one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is extending a bit the capabilities of property checks. You know, I use these all the time, and the various non-locality restrictions are prevent me from being able to describe a lot of things that I'd like to be able to. Is there anyone working on that?
Well, yes and no. Yes, people. I mean, the trouble is, it's quite difficult to extend the capability to sort of loosen the restrictions on role inclusion axioms without causing undecidability. So people have been working on looking at how those restrictions are defined and finding ways that the restrictions can be relaxed without the language becoming undecidable. But to be honest, that probably doesn't really still give you everything that you want. In some ways, the rule extension I was mentioning before seems more likely to give you the kind of thing you want, in as much as if you could also use arbitrary rules, I'm sure you would be able to define the relation the way you want to. The limitation there is that for maintaining decidability, the semantics is usually defined such that these rules only apply to the named individuals. So they sort of affect, you know, query answers that involve individuals to which you have names, but they don't cause new subsumption inferences that depend on reasoning about, existentially quantified individuals for which you don't have names.
Okay, I think that capability will solve a lot of my problems. Thanks.
Yeah, okay.
Ian, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Joel Bender.
Godfrey.
Hi, this is Joel from Cornell University. Thank you very much for this talk, by the way. It's excellent. Where can I go to learn more about this saturation technique and what kinds of sample projects and things are available to actually see it in action?
Do you mean the saturation of the T-bot? So
yes.
The reasoning technique that uses saturation of the axioms?
Yes.
Yeah. The basically the sort of definitive paper on that was a paper at DigiKai, I'm wanting to say 2009, but I think it was 2009, and it was from a guy called Yevgeny Kazakov, who actually works here at Oxford, and he also has an implementation of that in a reasoner that was this one I showed the statistics for. It's called VB. His reasoner, C for Charlie, B for Bertie. Don't ask why. That's open source, I think. It's at least freely available. I think it's written in something like OCaml, though, so it's not necessarily so easy to integrate it into applications, but you can get that. You can play with it.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Doug,
yeah. Hey, this is Doug.
You were talking about a meta modeling. You are basically saying it seems like that you are faking it, using the same term twice, but you are not relating the two. So this would prevent a reasoner from handling a rule that uses the term in both ways. Is there some way again of getting around this?
You're right in saying that it's faking it in a certain sense. This is why it's called punning. You know, it's a pun because you use the same name to mean two different things. So in a sense it's faking it, but it doesn't prevent the reasoner from doing anything. What it does is it prevents the reasoner from using inferences at the meta level to impact on classes at the class level,
and then
have that flow down to the individual level.
Yeah. Okay. The example that I put in the chat was saying if some species is an endangered species and prey is an instance of that species and a hunter, et cetera, and a hunter kills a prey, then but even though you use the same variable for same species and instance the endangered species, something is an instance of it, that linkage doesn't appear.
No, I believe that you can probably ask a query that, you know, if you can ask a query that says something like, you know, give me individuals that are hunted by people give me individuals that hunt a species that is a kind of endangered species or something like that. You could ask a query like that. That wouldn't be a problem.
Here you say if somebody hunts a species, then you're already using a species at the individual level. But if you're talking about if somebody kills an animal, that animal is an instance of a species, and that species is an instance of endangered species. Then you're using the two levels at the same time.
Yeah, which is still that isn't a problem. The problem arises, what you lose is when some inference at the meta level actually affects classes at the class level. For example, if you were to say at the meta level that I can't think of a good example. Two names were the names of the, were two names for the same class, right? So if I were to say at the meta level, C1 and C2 are both
the same class, actually. Then, okay. If I assert that A is an individual, it is an instance of C1, I should be able to deduce that it's also an instance of C2, because, you know, at the meta level, I said C1 and C2 were the same class, so they must have the same instances. I wouldn't get that kind of... That wouldn't work, because then I really need the inferences to be simultaneously operating over all three layers.
Right.
But providing I don't expect inferences to sort of simultaneously operate over all three layers, everything will work okay. I mean, typically that's the way people use meta classes, because typically they really use it more in a kind of annotation way, like into species. You know, that's just an annotation which I then have a list of species which are these kind of endangered species. You know,
right.
My favorite classes, that kind of...
Endangered species, like there are laws for treatment of members of endangered species, which means members of members of endangered.
Yes, if you had something at the meta level that said, for all instances of endangered species, something applies, which is a kind of class-level restriction on the classes, and you needed that restriction in order to make some inference at the individual level, that wouldn't work. But I haven't seen an ontology that looks like that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Doug.
Brian Hawk.
I think, Ian, you probably haven't seen them because they don't work. This is Alan. This is a comment on that. There are a number of things like that. You can do things in tools and they can be used to guide tools. That particular reasoning is just one that isn't supported.
Of course, it's always hard to know when you don't see things in ontologies, whether it's because people don't want to do them or because the current tool set doesn't support that thing. It's this the sort of chicken and egg situation. I completely agree. And actually, it isn't really a convincing argument to say I just haven't seen it. And so, yes, it may be useful. It isn't supported. I contend that what is supported is fairly useful and covers quite a large percentage of the cases where people use metaclasses, but that's a very subjective argument. That
while you're online, Alan, you had a remark about the Manchester system, slide 15. Thanks, Alan. So back to the queue. Brian talk. Okay, since we are running close to time limit, two more minutes, so two more questions. And we still have to take two. Tom Russ, and then followed by Chiu Tao. Thanks, Tom. Chiu Tao? Doctor? Yes, go ahead. Okay, afraid that will have to be the final question. Thank you very much, Professor Horrocks, for a great presentation. Of course, on behalf of the community, thank you for last week, this week, and the coming week. So, for those of you who haven't already registered for next week's session, which would be our two tools and applications, where we will be having a panel session with Professor Horace as the chair and a whole bunch of expert panelists telling us about tools and applications, our tools. So be here. And once again, if you're not part of the Ontolog community, I think what we do here is of interest. Good. On that note, thanks again, and goodbye.